May it please the court. There is no dispute that on its face, Ms. Hall's pro se post-conviction motion is timely. We also know that the pro se motion is actually timely, as the Department of Corrections confirmed and I included in my appendix in pages 18 through 20. Now, that evidence was not before the Southern District or the motion court to consider, but I thought it proper for this court to be to know that the evidence does exist. Here, the Southern District, sua sponte, found the pro se motion to be untimely because there is no evidence in the record to support when Ms. Hall was delivered to the Department of Corrections, and the motion court made no finding as to whether the pro se motion was timely. It was unfair to Ms. Hall that her timely pro se motion was dismissed due to no fault of her own. I want to address first why the Southern District should have presumed, and this court should presume, that the motion was timely. Second, if this court finds that the record is silent as to delivery date and will not presume the motion to be timely, then the proper remedy is to remand for a finding as to whether the motion was timely, not to dismiss a facially timely motion. And third, if time allows, I want to address, if this court finds the motion to be timely and reaches the merits of Ms. Hall's claim, this court should remand for resentencing on the Class D felony of driving while intoxicated. First, the Southern District erred when it extended this court's opinion in Doris v. State to apply not only to when motions are filed, but also when the movement is delivered to the Department of Corrections. Instead, the Southern District and this court should presume the motion court was timely for three reasons. First, the motion is timely on its face. Ms. Hall filed the motion well within the 180-day time limit. Second, the state did not contest timeliness, knowing this case could easily be disposed if the pro se motion was untimely. And third, the court can infer the motion was timely because the motion court found previous counsel had abandoned Ms. Hall and accepted an untimely amended motion and reached the merits of Ms. Hall's claim. The motion court could not do this unless it found the pro se motion to be timely. The Southern District upended decades of practice where the rule was, and this is not explicitly in the rule or any case law, but it's my experience from talking to post-conviction attorneys who have been practicing in this area for decades, is if the motion is timely on its face, there's a presumption that it is timely. And if the state or the court raises an issue about timeliness, ask, well, it seems that she was delivered to the Department of Corrections many months after she was sentenced, what happened here, then the burden shifts back to the movement to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that she was delivered to the Department of Corrections in this case on March 5th, 2013, as was asserted in the amended motion and the pro se motion. This court said in Doris that it is the court's duty to enforce the mandatory time limit. The Southern District should have presumed that the motion court followed its duty and enforced the mandatory time limits in the post-conviction rule and found that the motion was timely, and that's why they reached the merits of the claim. Instead, they extended this court's opinion in Doris to apply to when someone is delivered to the Department of Corrections, which has never been done before. If this court disagrees that there should be some presumption here and adopts the Southern District's approach, then this court should remand for a timeliness hearing because it's the court's duty to enforce the mandatory time limits of Rule 24035. Therefore, the motion court needed to make an explicit finding in the record or in the sentence and judgment here that the pro se motion was timely or untimely, one way or the other. The court failed to do this. Admittedly, post-conviction counsel for Ms. Hall and the state also did not raise this issue at the motion court. However, I think what respondent and I are arguing about here is really what was the distinction in Doris? Why in Doris did this court treat, and it was a consolidated appeal, two of the movements different than the other movement. And the first two movements were Doris and Lopez McCurdy. And the other one was Hill. And this court remanded to dismiss the first two movements' claims because the motion was untimely. But this court treated Hill differently. This court remanded Hill's case back to determine whether the motion was timely because there was an open factual question about whether the untimely motion on its face was actually timely, but excused because of one of the exceptions outside the control of the movement. Now, respondent believes that the distinction here is that is what the court said at the very end of its opinion, that movement was induced to not produce this evidence at the evidentiary hearing. But this seems internally inconsistent with its position in its brief and how it understands Doris. On one hand, it wants to say that the presumption in these procedural matters is on the movement to prove by a preponderance of the evidence when they're delivered to the Department of Corrections, when their motion is filed, when the sentencing transcript is submitted to run the time limit for the amended motion, all these procedural matters, they say that is squarely on the movement. But on the other hand, they say, well, the state induced Movement Hill to not put forth that evidence. That seems internally inconsistent. Either the movement has the burden to prove this, and the state can't withdraw and Hill that withdraw its motion to dismiss and therefore induce him or her not to put forth this evidence. But if the burden is always on the movement to prove it, it doesn't matter whether the state files a motion to dismiss or withdraws its motion to dismiss. If that burden is squarely on the movement, then they can't. That would be irrelevant. So I think the distinction is the one I drew in my reply brief. Instead, if you look at the briefs in that case, and it's not really explicit in the opinion, but the movements in Lopez and McCurdy and Doris, they conceded their motion was untimely, but the state had waived that, and the court rejected that the state can waive those types of things. So the court said, well, you conceded your motion was untimely, it's dismissed. But in Hill, Hill did not do that. He said, well, there's a reason why it was late and we didn't put forth that evidence. We want the opportunity to put forth that evidence. That's the same case here. And even more importantly, and I think that's what distinguishes Doris even more from this case, is this motion is timely on its face, unlike in Doris where all three of those motions were untimely on its face.
So you're saying Doris requires you to come forth with affirmative proof only where on its face you don't plead sufficiently to come within the statutory deadlines.
I think that's a distinction that could be made, and really how it's been operating in the lower courts is if the motion is timely on its face, there's no need to produce cumulative evidence to prove why an otherwise facially timely motion is actually timely.
Since no answer is required, how would you know whether it's a contested issue or not?
Well, I think here it's because it's the court's duty to ensure that it is timely and that they should ask a question if for some reason they find that there's some issue in it. And here I can understand why a court, and maybe the motion court not on the record, asked or the prosecutor asked, hey, man, they were sentenced in November. Why are they were delivered to the Department of Corrections in March? And there's a good reason for that. And here it's not in the record, but I can tell you after talking to counsel who represented Ms. Hall below, was that she was delivered to the Jasper County Jail because she had another case pending there. And that's why she wasn't delivered to the Department of Corrections. I would not be surprised if the prosecutor saw the pro se motion and the amended motion and said, that's strange, and called up to the Department of Corrections, said, when was she delivered to the Department of Corrections? They said, well, it was on that date, March 5th, the same letter that I sent you. Now, that's not in the record, and I think it would have been better practice for the court to raise that issue and if they had an issue with it and address it below. And I think I want to direct this court's attention to a case that's not in my brief, and it's the Eastern District in Pollitt versus State, which just came out March 14th of this year, and that can be found at Westlaw 977-260. And I'll be happy to provide a letter brief after. And in that case, the Eastern District remanded a 24035 case because they could not determine when the sentencing transcript and the guilty plea transcript were filed, which is important for running the 60-day time limit for the amended motion. They said, we can't see in the record when this happened. There's two dates, maybe. It's ambiguous on which one it is. One would make it timely, one would make it untimely. And they said, well, because we can't determine this, and the motion court failed to address it in their findings of fact and conclusions of law, they remanded the case. They didn't say that, oh, well, the movement didn't prove by a preponderance of the evidence when the transcript was filed. They said, looking at Doris, that it is the court's duty to ensure that these motions are timely and don't waste needless resources on litigating untimely motions. And they actually have an important footnote in there, kind of criticizing both attorneys and judges for not ensuring that these are timely and wasting the court's time with these issues. So I think it's important that motion courts address this in their findings of fact and conclusions of law and say whether the pro se motion is timely or untimely so we don't have another case like this. Now, if the court is unwilling to pursue this, the motion is timely, this court should do exactly the same thing it did in Doris with Movin Hill and should do exactly the same thing as the Eastern District did in Paulett and remand the case back to the lower court to address whether the motion was timely or not, and this court can consider, or the Southern District can consider, whether that was clearly erroneous or not. What this court should not do is dismiss Ms. Hall's timely motion. This was no fault of her own. And I just have 20 seconds, so I want to quickly just mention my third point, which is I don't believe that this case is properly brought on post-conviction. This is not a claim about sufficiency of the information. It is whether the state proved that that there was a factual basis for this plea. It is our position that they did not, and therefore the state failed to meet its burden, and therefore Ms. Hall should only have been convicted of the Class B felony of driving while intoxicated. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Counsel opened his argument by asking this court to draw presumptions from the facts that are pled in the Rule 24035 motion. But of course, this court's well-established jurisprudence is that because these are collateral attacks on a judgment, that post-conviction pleadings are treated differently than other civil pleadings and that inferences are not drawn from bare allegations in the motion. Now, what makes this case unique, frankly, from the majority of the guilty plea cases I have handled, is that there was an evidentiary hearing in this case. And once an evidentiary hearing is conducted under subsection I of Rule 2403, the movement has the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence the matters that show that he or she is entitled to relief. And as Doris said, one of those matters is whether the motion is timely or not. Now, again, no.
Is it misleading for the state to say nothing about that and then just raise it on appeal?
Well, we never raised it on appeal. Let's be quite honest about that. This was totally the Court of Appeals on its own coming up with this. We did not. But again, as the court has said many times, including in Doris, because timeliness is a threshold issue and an untimely motion constitutes a complete waiver under the rule, it's not a matter that the state can waive. It's not an affirmative defense that the state has to plead. It's not like a statute of limitations that can be waived.
What's wrong with remanding for a hearing on that issue?
Well, this really comes, let me analogize it in this way. Let's say I'm prosecuting a civil case where I've got the burden of proving elements 1, 2, 3, and 4. My opponent only actively contests 3. That does not relieve me of the burden of proving the existence of 1, 2, and 4, absent perhaps a stipulation from the other side. And typically, what we're talking about is whether the burden of proof was met. When a party tries a case and fails to meet their burden of proof on the issue, we don't typically say, well, we'll give you a second chance to go back and do that again.
Well, do we do that sometimes when none of the parties or the court realized they needed to prove something? Do we send it back for further hearing?
I'm not aware of that being done in the context of an evidentiary hearing, and typically where that this kind of issue seems to arise is in the context of whether prior and persistent offender status has been proven. That's where I've seen it most often. And what the Emery case, I think, said, where the state made no effort to prove the issue, it doesn't get a second crack at it. When it tried to prove it, but somehow that was defective, In some of those cases, that can be done. And I think the Matthews case that was cited in Mr. Lemberg's brief was one of those situations where the information had pled the priors correctly at the guilty plea hearing. They weren't connected up, and on remand, the state was then allowed to establish that. And I guess it depends on whether the court views this as an instance of whether the movement defectively tried to prove the timeliness of the motion, or whether the movement completely failed to try and prove the timeliness of the motion. And I would say that in the latter case, that would fall under Emery. If the court views it differently, that is more a Matthews type of situation, then a remand under those circumstances would probably be appropriate there. So again, it comes into the prism in which this is viewed, and I think it has to be viewed through the lens of subsection I of the rule, and whether the appellant met his burden by simply not even addressing the issue before the motion court.
Is Mr. Lemberg right that decades of practice has been that attorneys have not felt the need to prove that?
Well, again, this is one of the very few cases that I've seen an evidentiary hearing in a guilty plea. I can tell you that most of the evidentiary hearings are in Rule 2915, which I think presents a little different situation, because the triggering date in virtually every one of those cases is the date that the appellate court issued the mandate in the direct appeal. And what you'll usually see in those hearings is that the court at the hearing will be asked at the beginning to take judicial notice of its files in the underlying case, which would include that mandate that it received from the appellate court. So that's a matter of record that can be clearly established. I would even go so far as to suggest that in a case like this, if you've got a situation where the motion was filed within 180 days of when the sentence was executed, that could properly, I think, be viewed as prima facie evidence that the motion is timely. We've got the unusual situation here where there was a significant delay of 4 or 5, maybe 6 months between the execution of sentence and the alleged date of delivery to the Department of Corrections, which I think is what caught the attention of the Court of Appeals. I don't know how often a situation like this is going to come up.
Well, it's going to come up every time there's an evidentiary hearing in a 24035. Because isn't it, you're exactly right. They ask for a stipulation as to the court file, but yeah. There's very rarely any evidence presented as to when the defendant was delivered to the Department of Corrections. No, if we follow your rationale here, every pending 24035 that had an evidentiary hearing would have to be dismissed to respond.
I don't know that it had to be dismissed. I think once the evidentiary hearing is granted, that gives the movement the chance to prove their date of delivery, which I don't think is a difficult burden to meet. You can get records from the Department of Corrections, as Mr. Lemberg did. You could get a stipulation from the state.
Well, you could ask the defendant or the movement.
Exactly, and the court could take right. that as competent evidence of that. Not a difficult thing to do at all.
But my point is that if we have all these here, that we've already had a hearing, and there's an appeal pending on 24035 where there was a hearing, mm-hmm. if we follow your logic and argument, then I would dare to say there hasn't been evidence presented when it's undisputed that the defendant was delivered 2 days later to the Department of Corrections. And if that evidence isn't there, then right now they haven't established the timeliness.
Certainly, and that's, I don't know how many of those cases would be out there, because as I said, I've seen very few evidentiary hearings in guilty plea cases, though I think I may have just gotten one yesterday. And that, I think, is from a judicial management standpoint, I guess what the court has to consider, is it better to give those movements a chance to prove it at that point or not? Again, it's not necessarily an issue that we feel strongly about as to whether or not they should be given that chance. It's just giving some clear direction so we know how to move forward in the future, I think, is our point. I think probably just to turn very briefly to the merits of the case, I think Mr. Lemberg ended his argument by saying that the appropriate remedy, if the merits are addressed, is to remand for resentencing. However, the claim here is lack of a sufficient factual basis, and that ties into the issue of whether or not the plea was knowing and voluntary when it was entered. And if the plea was unknowing and involuntary because of a lack of factual basis, the proper remedy is to vacate the plea. He can have a trial if he wants, or she can have a trial if she wants. She can perhaps go through another plea hearing. if the case were remanded again under Matthews, because the state did attempt to put in some evidence, though not extrinsic evidence, of the prior convictions, but they were simply mislabeled in the information, the state, I think, under Matthews would be given the chance to correct that. So it's not a case where the state completely failed to prove up the priors and therefore the movement's entitled to a reduced sentence. That's not the proper remedy under, you know, the claim as it's brought before the court. And of course, our contention is that because the evidence of the prior convictions to establish the factual basis was limited to what was in the charging document, what's really being alleged here is an insufficiency of the charging document, which is one of the rare basis on which a direct appeal from a guilty plea can be brought, and it should have been brought under that.
But they are claiming you didn't prove it. Whether that you also failed in the information, they're claiming you didn't prove it.
I think the cases, though, that the appellant relies on are all cases where there was some extrinsic evidence aside from the charging document itself that was brought in, and that was a failure of proof. And here there was just a reference to the charging document. So if you're saying
that
the evidence was
insufficient to prove it, is what they're saying, though.
It was insufficient because of a mistake in the charging document, though.
But they weren't complaining about the mistake in the charging document. They complained you didn't prove it. The only evidence you offered was the charging document.
Well,
that's not a complaint that you should have charged them differently, that you didn't prove it.
They're phrasing it that way, but I don't think in reality that's what it is. I think in reality it is a claim that the charging document was insufficient to establish her prior or her aggravated offender status. So that was a direct appeal issue. And if the court has anything further, thank you.
Mr. Lindbergh, the state has cited basic law that says an individual has an obligation at a hearing to present evidence to prove the allegations in their pleading. And my question is, I know that you're saying in Doris the court remanded, but is there anything legally erroneous about the findings of the Southern District?
Well, I think they unnecessarily extended this court's opinion in Doris to apply not only to when the motion is filed, but also to when the delivery to the Department of Corrections. I don't think that's this court
is
has.
Is that the only way you prove the motion's timely filed, is to know when someone's delivered to the Department of Correction?
Not necessarily, but in this case, that would be the only way. So in 24035, it's delivery to the Department of Corrections and 180 days later.
Right, and so it could have the presumption that was suggested by Mr. McPherson that it, if it falls within the date of the 180 days of sentencing, then we can presume. But my question is this, whether you're asking us to, you ask us to consider decades of practice, but is there a legal basis for us ruling that the defendant doesn't have to prove what is a requirement of their claim? And if in fact the law supports what the Southern District did, then do we have the discretionary ability to remand for taking additional evidence, even though the legal conclusion reached by the Southern District was correct?
Well, I think in Doris you guys did this exact same thing where you remanded for an opportunity to prove this.
And did we state that there was a principle of law that supported that is my question, or did we just exercise discretion and remand?
I guess you exercised discretion and remanded it, but I don't think the rule 24035 requires it explicitly that you have to prove this. 24035 says you have to prove your claims for relief by a preponderance of the evidence. And I understand this court in Doris extended that to issues of timeliness, but I think that Doris should be more narrowly read to apply to the specific facts in Doris, which was untimely motions on its face, and the motions were filed well after the 180-day time, or in that case, it was 90, because those were all 2915 cases after the mandate had issued. And I think it should be more narrowly read to those circumstances and those types of cases.
And even
and
if
not,
we don't extend the ruling in Doris, though, is there some legal concept that a motion has to be timely filed. We've said if it's not timely filed, it waives all claims. We've said the court has an obligation to sua sponte determine the timeliness. So don't all of those holdings require the movement to prove, have in the record the timeliness?
And if the court does that, I would concede we would lose, but I just say that counsel, attorneys that are practicing in this area have never interpreted Doris to apply to when delivery to the Department of Corrections. So attorneys, and I think Justice Powell is echoing this, that there are potentially hundreds of cases out there, because usually people aren't delivered to the Department of Corrections the day of. It takes a day or two, and in some cases it takes many months. It seems deeply unfair.
You're saying it was unclear before and after Doris whether or not you had to prove this, and if the court finds you do, it would be appropriate to remand because no one realized that was the necessary element of proof.
Right. If this court clarifies for the first time that you need to prove with the Department of Corrections, and I echo Mr. McPherson's, a clear rule like that would help attorneys practicing in this area that and would be put on notice for the first time that you need to prove when they're delivered to the Department of Corrections. And the court is obviously well within its authority to do that.
And I know your time's up, but real quick question. So I assume the pro se motion filed by your client was verified as required by the rule.
Correct. So I talked to post-conviction attorney here, and the way he did it was he actually got on the Department of Corrections website and looks at when the picture is taken.
But my point is, did you ever research or look into the fact that the verified petition, which alleges that she was delivered on March 5th, whatever mm-hmm. that date was, could support the evidence necessary?
Whether that would independently be enough?
Mm-hmm. Since it was verified.
Since it was verified. And there was no contrary evidence presented. And if you didn't look at it, I
didn't look at it to be fair with you.
All right, fair enough. That's not that you required.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.